I'm glad my healthcare system's not my bank, on Insights in Nursing. Welcome back to another episode here of Insights in Nursing. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, and we've got a great panel here. And since it's been a few weeks since we've been able to pull a panel together, I want to jump right into the show. And so real quickly here, let's go ahead and introduce our panel for today. We are joined by Victoria Powell from VP Medical. And Victoria, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Jamie. I'm glad to be here.
And we've got you coming in by cell phone connection, so hopefully we'll be stable there and be able to hear you, because I'm looking forward to your impressions of this week's articles.
Great.
And we're also joined by Rick Rosati from mitigationjournal.org. How you doing, Rick?
Doing fine, Jamie. Thanks for having me back here on Insights, and welcome to all the listeners. Nice to be here.
Yeah, it's going to be a good show. We've got a couple of good articles that I want to just jump right into. And one of them has to do with nurses struggling to implement evidence-based practice, saying that there is resistance from nurse leaders and other leaders in the facilities to them implementing something that has been proven by evidence to be an effective practice. Victoria, you look at these types of things all the time, and how do nurse leaders and other leaders get away with discounting something that has got evidence behind it?
Well, I think one of the big key points of this article is the fact that, you know, education in nursing schools has certainly changed. The article indicates that the more education you have, the more likely the nurses would support evidence-based practice. But they were saying that while the higher-ups at the hospital were pointing out that they should be using evidence-based practice, they really weren't. They put it out there that you're supposed to be doing it, but they didn't do anything to really teach or support or mentor the people as they were trying to input evidence-based practice. The average respondent in this particular study was 47, and of the average nurse population in that age range, we, and myself included, was not educated when evidence-based practice. That was not part of my nursing education. So I can certainly see where for the older nurses, we've always done it this way. You know, change is difficult for people, and I can see where that would be a difficult thing for them to even not necessarily buy into. I think they get it. I mean, that's what evidence-based practice is all about, is actually seeing the evidence before your eyes that this is a good study and this this is something that we should be doing. But one of the first comments on this page is actually from a nurse leader. Her name is Ayla Arcade, and she is actually a friend of mine. And I think she hit the nail on the head. She said that the term evidence-based practice has not really been clearly defined for nurses. And her question is, are we basing nursing practice on medical research or on nursing research? Because the information that's shared in the article is about asthma patients who come into the ER and they're given nebulizer. But we know from evidence-based practice that using a metered dose inhaler with a spacer has got fewer side effects. That's a medical issue. That's not a nursing issue. So her, I can see we're in magnet hospitals where they were really working to educate and adopt evidence-based. It's what magnet status is all about. But Alias talks about this, about we're a distinct healthcare profession that's separate from medicine. And we should be really doing our own research. And we should have our own nursing-based research in focusing on perhaps our nursing diagnosis rather than just medical diagnosis. And I'm not saying by any means to discount evidence-based practice at all, but if the physician is calling the shot on the medicine-based practice, then, I mean, what are we supposed to do? Yes, we can question the physician's choice for using, in that particular case, a nebulizer versus metered dose inhaler. But that's really outside the standard of care for nurses to actually, make that decision on which we're going to use.
Well, it is outside of that, and we're supposed to be implementing the orders. And I guess we could make a suggestion that there might be a better alternative to treat a given patient. But you're right. I mean, that call for prescribing a certain medication in a given situation is the doctor's call in that situation. And you know, after you've made your suggestion, you still need to go ahead and administer whatever
and implement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you still need to go ahead and do it. Rick, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, first of all, I truly appreciate Victoria's insight into this. And I have to say, Victoria, I'm with you 100% on that. And matter of fact, my notes from this article is almost as if you wrote them yourself. It's amazing that we're on the same page with this. You know, I've got a couple comments on this particular article in and of itself that I'd like to start with, Jamie. And I find it curious that the article here quotes that by 2020, I think the IOM said that 90% of patient care decisions should be evidence-based. Now, that to me says that a whole lot of research has still got to go on in order to make that goal. And that brings me around to something that Victoria mentioned, that who is doing that research? Are we doing medical research or are we doing nursing research to define evidence-based practice? And I really do think that question's got to be answered before we can speak any further as whether or not we can make 90% of our patient care decisions in nursing based on evidence-based practice. So I found that very curious in this article. And also, kind of as an aside, the article notes that they sent out 20,000 randomized self-report surveys and got just over 1,000 back. I would expect a little bit better, especially if we're targeting. I'm sorry, I lost you.
I said it's sad. That's the part of the problem. Nurses are not and they're not stepping up. And that's just one more evidence of that, but they won't even fill out a survey.
Yeah, I found that really interesting also that, you know, and the question that's circulating in my mind around that is that was it the nurses with higher educations, the ones that were more likely to fill out the survey versus the ones with lower education? Now, I don't want to put a disparity in there between nursing education, but that's just something that goes unanswered that I'd like to see that answer to really flesh out this issue a little bit more. So that's another thing that I just kind of as an aside there. And I also found the implication of magnet designation that's put out by the American Nurses Credentialing Center as an important role in the adoption of evidence-based care. And I've gotten in tune with this a lot lately. I've been asked to serve as the magnet champion for my floor. So I've kind of jumped into the whole credentialing process with both feet. And you know, it's interesting that the more you dig into this, the more you find out that evidence-based practice does, in fact, make a difference in better patient outcomes, but also in saving healthcare dollars. And, you know, it kind of brings us back full circle. Are we talking now simply about medical research? Are we talking about nursing research? Or should we be looking at evidence-based practice from a more holistic, full healthcare perspective? So I don't know the answer to that question. I just kind of throw it out there for discussion, folks.
Well, Rick, on that, on the evidence-based practice being cost-saving, I definitely agree that if we have evidence to support a particular medical intervention, if we're not doing that, then certainly then there's going to be either a side effect or something, just like in this nebulizer example, there could be a side effect, which would then be more costly. So that certainly plays into the dollar figures. But I do think there's going to have to be a combination, and I think it's going to be the nurses who need to step up and do the nursing evidence-based research as well. The speaker who I mentioned who was in the comments said, when Nightingale introduced nursing into hospital-based practice or hospital-based care, it was evident that more people got well. It was not the introduction of more physicians or medical practice that produced the improved outcomes. With the advancements in medicine and medical technology, our overall healthcare indicators in the U.S. still are declining. And they're begging for nurses to step up and provide that whole person perspective, you know, which would be in case management, family education. And, you know, with this new healthcare policy that's coming into play, I think nurses are going to have to step up and we're going to have to start doing some more of the education and includes research. if we're not doing our own research to back up what we know, you know, what we feel like we know, then we're doing ourselves a disjustice as a discipline.
I completely agree, Victoria. I think that, you know, the support for and the initiation of high quality nursing research is really one of the keys to this continuing to grow and continuing to get better. I mean, evidence-based practice, there can be best practices in medical care, but there also needs to be strong research backing up best practices in nursing care. And both of those together, I think, are going to make significant changes in cost effectiveness and in our ability to heal patients more effectively. I mean, we're going to be talking about lots of better outcomes if we're constantly improving.
Well, I'd like to add that, again, to coattail a little bit more on what Victoria was saying, that nursing in general, I think, is best poised to conduct this research. And I'll qualify my statement by saying nursing, as we all know, is directly at the bedside, is in tune with what's going on with the patient hourly, or at least they should be, in my opinion. And we, in some cases, are uniquely qualified to see the pre-hospital interventions as they impact the patient, and the in-hospital medical decisions as they impact the patient. So what better position than the bedside nursing staff to be involved with this educational research, that to put it into play than the rank and file? And I really do think that's where it's got to come from. We can see it from both ends. And Jamie, I just mentioned that because I know you and I both cross-pollinate as pre-hospital care providers as well as nurses. And I think it's important to add that in, that healthcare starts before the person gets to the facility. And that has an impact as well. And that's got to be measured.
It certainly does. And I agree with you. I think that any kind of evidence-based research that is not purely cellular research or some kind of, you know, abstract research, I think any kind of evidence-based research around patient care needs to directly involve nurses, because nurses are the ones who enact the care that is ordered. Nurses are the ones that are interacting with the patients consistently day in, day out. And ultimately, that's the way that we can see how just little changes make a difference. It's amazing, and we all three have seen it in our care of patients. Little things that you do make big differences to the patient.
And I think one thing that we have to do is to answer the question, who is going to define evidence-based practice? I'm afraid that if we collectively wait for someone else to define evidence-based practice, that we won't like that definition very much. So I think it's in our best interest to be proactive. And as we've talked about so far for this last many minutes, make that evidence-based practice based on research, including nursing diagnosis, rather than simply the medical diagnosis.
Victoria, what's going on in case management with regard to evidence-based practice? Do you see that's being brought into play more and more frequently? I know you're involved in helping with case management practice, and do you see that being involved more often?
I think more research is being done in that area, and I think this change to the healthcare law is kind of producing that, if you will. We know we have quite a bit of evidence in case management. That's one of the reasons, one of the areas that we actually do have quite a bit of evidence-based practice. But the CMSA, the Case Management Society of America, is a quite large organization and covers everything from utilization review to discharge planning to community case management, in-house and outpatient case management. And what we're being told through CMSA is that the way that the healthcare law is written right now, we're already seeing some evidence of this on the DRGs, you know, the Medicare allowable, you know, if they have a certain problem, they're not going to pay within so much time of the hospitalization. Well, we're already seeing that in evidence in the Medicare law. So what's going to happen, what we're seeing now, or at least what we're being told through CMSA is part of the healthcare law, is that we're going to have to do a lot more education of that patient in between visits and not let them get to the severity that causes all of the issues and the hospitalizations and so forth. So it sounded initially like we were really going to be talking about primary care physicians, but as we know, there's not as many primary care physicians as we're going to need to be that medical home type environment for these patients. And I think a lot of that is going to fall into the hands of the case manager to handle.
What do you think, you know, it occurs to me because the primary care physicians actually had a big meeting this week. And one of the things that they released was an infographic I saw online that has the future of primary care practice in the United States. And right smack dab in the middle in a big box is comparing nursing education, physician education, and saying patients prefer physicians to be in charge of their care. So primary care is, I think, going to fall, I'm biased, right? I'm a nurse. So I'm going to think that nurses have a place in primary care management of patients.
Oh, absolutely.
But clearly the physicians are holding on to their monopoly of that care.
Yes, but I don't think that's my opinion is, I don't think that's going to last that long because we're not producing enough primary care physicians to handle the amount of patients that we're having. And with the new healthcare laws and all of the requirements and keeping them healthy, it's going to fall on someone to educate them. Well, if you've been into a physician's office lately, they don't have time to educate you because they don't have time. If they spend more time, they don't get reimbursed. They're losing money for every visit that they're spending with you. Past about, 5 or 10 minutes. So it's going to have to be somebody else. It may be a combination of nursing staff with primary care or something, but there's going to have to be some kind of connection so that patient knows where to get information. And, some of our big carriers have these call a nurse or ask a nurse fields where they can call on the phone and talk to somebody and find out whether or not this constitutes them going to the doctor or to the ER. And I think we're going to see a lot more of that. I think it's going to be a combination where in order to stop people from using the ER as their primary care, we're going to have to pick up the ball and talk about education. And we're going to have to get that to the people who are not currently under the care of any kind of primary care provider. Now, who that primary provider is going to be, whether it's a nurse practitioner or a primary care, I don't know. But somehow they're going to have to get into some type of primary care type care so that they can be educated and we can reduce the healthcare costs.
And primary care, I think, in tandem with that, primary care is going to have to expand the types of services it provides. It's not just about a physical once a year or once every 2 years and sick visits. It's about providing an overall healthcare support system to that patient to enable them to be healthier. And right now, the primary care system, for the most part, is not set up to do that because you're just as you said, the physician does not have time to sit with a patient after saying, diagnosing them with a high cholesterol problem and spend the time to educate them about healthy eating, changing their habits, and doing all the things they need to do to lower their cholesterol. So the solution is almost always pharmacological because that's a quick fix and gets the physician on to their next patient, which they need to do to pay the bills. I'm not putting down that part of the system. But who's going to have to do that education, that additional education? It's got to be the nurses. Rick?
And Jamie, this kind of segues to another topic, and I don't want to get off on tangents here, but, there's been some articles written recently about the urgent care center businesses, which have been growing by leaps and bounds, including retail healthcare centers, for exactly that reason. They offer convenience. They offer just-in-time treatment without the expense of an emergency department, without the long waits at a physician's office. But one of the criticisms of urgent care or walk-in care centers is they lack that patient education piece because they are so targeted to get people in and out in rapid form. And again, who's going to pick up those pieces of education, where we know as much as we can sit back and say, you know, increasing the education of nurses increases the quality of care and equates to better outcomes and more efficient use of healthcare dollars. We could also, I think, argue very, very well that increasing patient education is going to lead to better outcomes and a better use of healthcare dollars. So I think there's a number of fronts here, not just the in-office issue or the in-hospital issues, but also with the popularity of urgent care centers. There's another piece that opens up the door for nurses to be providing education to the patients. And, you know, there's so many ways we could be doing this through the use of social media and telemedicine and such, but who's going to tackle that? Who's going to make that happen remains to be the question.
Well, and you just named off about four different potential evidence-based practice patient improvement research options for a nurse right there. Because
absolutely.
That just shows that because we are discussing this and we don't have definitive research to back this up at this point, or a lot of definitive research, there are articles out there that talk about the efficacy of telehealth follow-ups by nurses on post-operative patients after discharge. We know that positively affects the patient's recovery. We've got to do more and more research about positive effects of nurses following up a primary care visit and following up with healthy options and healthy support, patient support. And you know, like I just said, there's how many different research options for a nurse are there in just what you just said, Rick?
And I'm a community case manager. I'm in the field with my patients, and I actually attend the doctor's appointments with them. And I talk to them in the interim between appointments, and I obviously take notes every time I talk to my patients. And they will tell me about symptoms that they're having. We'll talk about, I go through my assessment asking all the different kinds of questions that I can think of to qualify their pain or their symptoms. And then I make a list of those for the doctor. Now, granted, the patient should be doing that. And I try to get them to do that. But they don't always write down their questions. And if they do, they oftentimes fail to bring them with them to the appointment. When I go into the exam room with the patient and we're sitting and we're talking to the doctor, and the doctor's going through the issues with the patient, and he's getting ready to leave, you know, he quotes whatever it is that he wants to do for treatment. And a good doctor is going to ask, you know, do you have any questions? And oftentimes the patient forgets all of the symptoms that they've shared with me throughout the month between their last appointment. And I'm there to interject and say, you know, here's some other things that this patient shared with me over the last few weeks. You know, does this change your treatment plan in any way, shape, or form? And we get a chance to discuss those. And then when the treatment plan is actually given to the patient, our patients forget that they're supposed to be a partner in their own healthcare, and they just take whatever the doctor has to say. They don't talk about alternatives. There is no communication necessarily about even what that treatment plan means. And as a case manager, then that's where I take over. I explain the treatment plan, what it's supposed to do, what it looks like, where you're going to go, you know, on and on. And it kind of leads us into the Medscape article about the wasting of the $750 billion. That was the very first thing that they said was that you have to have a continuous learning healthcare system that puts the patient and clinician as partners. And for whatever reason, patients fail to recognize that they are supposed to be partners in their healthcare. They go and accept a doctor's opinion. If it's a surgical opinion, it's very rare for me to ever have a patient go and get a second opinion. They just take it on face value that this is what I have to do. That's very disturbing to me.
But isn't there an inherent problem in the way that physicians are trained to present their treatment options to patients or their treatment decisions to patients? I don't think I've ever had a doctor explain to me or put it to me that I had an option on treatment.
It's very rare. I see a few, but that's only because I'm in doctor's offices on a daily basis. And you know, I have orthopedic for neurology in example, you know, a lot of times they'll talk about conservative care versus surgery. If someone is on the cusp of needing surgery, but they may, especially if the patient hesitates at all or frowns or grimaces about having to do surgery, then the doctor will sometimes talk about, well, we can try conservative care and this is what it's going to consist of. But that is definitely the exception rather than the rule, and it doesn't happen often. But well, as a case manager, that's part of my job is to say, you know, is there a conservative care option? What's going to happen if we wait? What, you know, would you welcome a second opinion?
What's going to happen if they say no? I don't welcome a second opinion.
I mean, that to me, what I say to my patients, if that happens, is that physician must not be confident enough in what they've recommended if they're not willing to let you have a second opinion. And I educate my patients on that fact that a good physician who's willing to stand behind their treatment plan would always welcome a second opinion because they're confident enough in their plan. So that's always a red flag to me.
Rick, what are your thoughts about, you know, this article on healthcare system wasting $750 billion in 2009, according to the Institute of Medicine, and the number of things that approach that it lists as the areas of waste in this article are astounding, and also, unfortunately, not all that surprising to me.
Right, and that was what I got from it too, Jamie, is the. That I was shocked about the amount of money, but at the same time, not exactly surprised in the areas in which it was, like the unnecessary and inefficiently delivered services. I mean, we see this every day. But I think part of that waste, that portion of the waste, really comes from our advertisements. We have drug companies, medical device companies, making recommendations, talking to our consumers, the patients, from their television set, their radio, their internet service, talking about the newest and latest and greatest. I had a patient just this last week who said, I don't understand why my doctor's not ordering an MRI. I mean, there's something wrong with my back. I need to have an MRI. And so it fell on me rather than the physician to explain that we do not base our treatment care on just having an MRI, that we need a physical exam to indicate then that we need an MRI or the lack of progress to the treatment plan or whatever the case might be. But the patients are programmed, if you will, to think that that's the way, if it's available, then we should be using it. And our physicians, unfortunately, have gotten away from the good old-fashioned hands-on, in-depth physical exam.
Well, I wish I could clap here over the internet and applaud that comment, Victoria. I agree with you. We seem to lean sometimes too heavily on very expensive technology, and I'm not opposed to using MRIs and other ultrasound and other types of technology. Please don't misunderstand me. But going back to what we were saying a little earlier about being able to explain the situation to the patient in a way that they can understand it and make them a better educated, if I can use the phrase, healthcare consumer, I think would help curb some of those things. It's listed in the article, unnecessary services and inefficiently delivered services. You have to stop and wonder what were the causative factors that led to the unnecessary services being used? What was the causative factor or factors in the inefficiency in the delivery of those services? And, you know, that's not really well spelled
out
here.
Yeah. We don't know if it was just the technology or the pressure from the consumer or what. Yeah, that's a good point, Rick.
Yeah. The one, you know, and I realize this is going to be the lowest one on the list here, coming in at a slim $55 billion, is the missed prevention opportunities. And I, with mm-hmm. all respect, would have to say that number, that dollar figure for missed prevention opportunities will probably be or would probably be exponentially larger if we were to include all the missed prevention opportunities when it comes to substance abuse and addiction. I'm not sure that was included in this report or not, or in the care of at-risk people, at-risk persons, or the mentally ill. And I have said for quite a while that if we looked back and if we went after dealing with mental illness as a true disease and substance abuse and addiction as a true disease, with the, if we went after those things with the same vigor we go after cardiovascular illnesses, we might not have to reform healthcare as much as we do, because I think those populations are drastically underserved. So I'm wondering if these missed prevention opportunities go deeper than what's represented by this $55 billion. My guess is that they do.
I would guess that they would too.
And another missed research opportunity.
Absolutely. The inefficiently delivered services was $130 billion. And this one is another area that case management, I really feel, will address. Last week, I had a patient who sees two or three different doctors, I believe, for his injury. Doctor number one wanted some lab tests done. He also ordered a CT scan, which was going to require him to have a creatinine clearance. And 2 days later, he sees a different doctor in his hometown who also wants labs. If I had not been involved, that gentleman would have gotten lab with doctor number one and then had lab with doctor number two, some of which were repeated, instead of one lab draw to take care of everything and do away with the duplicated request. It's simple little things like that. It's coordinating appointments. It's making sure that Dr. A knows what Dr. B is doing and vice versa. And that was part of this article, too, was talking about the electronic health records and where they're implementing the electronic health records. We're still losing some of that, I guess, connection between doctor and doctor to get data being used appropriately.
Well, and I like, and I'm trying to see if it was this article or another similar article that compares compares medical records management with banking records management. And
yeah, that's exactly this article.
Yeah, and makes the assumption and makes the argument that if your bank managed your electronic records at the bank in a way that your health records are managed, that you would, you know, you'd lose millions of dollars over the course of your lifetime. You'd never bank there again. And there are regulations that manage it.
They gave the airline one, and I really thought that one was amazing. It said airline pilots would be free to dispense with pre-flight safety checks. Retail stores would not have to display product prices in the aisles. I mean, that's our problem. Rick hit the nail on the head when he said healthcare consumer. Now, my personal opinion is part of our issue with healthcare consumerism, having the issues that we have, is that we have not we take our health care for granted. You have a copay. You're expecting that visit to only cost you $50 or $25. You're not looking at the total cost of what actually took place. For me, as a business owner, I have to buy a high deductible catastrophic plan. So when it comes for me to have a doctor's visit, I have to pay for the first $5,000 for every single person in my family. You tell me if I'm price checking. By golly, of course I am. If I have to have an MRI scan, I'm calling at the MRI scanner to see he's going to negotiate a cash price with me, because I want the best bang for my buck, because I don't have any health insurance that's going to take care of that for me. Well, our problem is that we have a disconnect between, oh, our insurance is paying for that, and not realizing that, no, you're actually paying for it. You just actually have insurance that's helping you offset these costs. That's part of what your insurance policy is about, is, you know, taking the risk. And if we're not paying attention to how our healthcare dollars are being spent now, I mean, I don't know how we're going to do that in the future. If everybody's going to be covered and nobody's looking for, you know, the best deal. I personally would have liked to have seen some type of exchange or, I don't know, coupon, something where you would have gotten more control over private industry. I mean, when I went to go negotiate an MRI price, I did not go to a hospital-based MRI. I looked for a community-based MRI because I knew that they would negotiate with me.
And you're one of the rare people in this world, or at least in this country, that would know to do that. How many people would honestly even consider the option of negotiating a price for a procedure such as an MRI or some such thing? I dare say most people wouldn't know to do that for exactly the reasons you mentioned.
Yeah. But that's about the only thing I ever see anybody check on is really pharmacy prices. And there's not enough of that. I mean, most of that is even, you know, the $4 prescription plans and things. I hear a lot of physicians say that they can get this on the $4 plan. It's not necessarily that the patient went to go find out on their own. It's that the physician told them that they could or prescribed a generic for that very reason if somebody spoke up and said they had to do it. But that's about the only area that I really see any kind of acknowledgement, I guess, of what the healthcare dollars are actually costing and how we can best use our resources.
Well, and I think that's going to change, Rick. I honestly do believe that because I know for my case, my wife's healthcare plan is changing this year. And so in 2013, we have to pay out of pocket for everything, just like Victoria was saying she was doing, up to a certain point per family member, or to a maximum for the entire family. But we are going to be paying for doctor's visits out of pocket, and we're going to be paying for those things. And, you know, while we are cringing a little bit, I ultimately said to my wife, this is a good thing. We're going to have a better idea of what we're spending on healthcare. You would never go and walk into a car dealership and say, all right, well, here's my $100 copay. Give me that Mercedes over there. It's brand new, right? Okay, take it out on the road.
Exactly.
And then you drive it for 2 months, and 2 months later, after your kids have spilled French fries in the back seat, and, you know, you've made a mess of this vehicle, you find out that, oh, by the way, your car insurance or whatever you want to call it only paid for $20,000 of that car, and you now owe $30,000. Mm-hmm. You would never buy a car that way, but we buy insurance that way all the time. And you're right.
That's right.
We need to educate patients.
That's right. And you know, if this crosses the line, you can edit it out later. But there is a percentage of our population that doesn't have that insight that you just described, that someone else is paying this bill.
What were you gonna say? Because that wasn't something I was gonna need to edit.
Now come on.
No, that's okay. I appreciate it, but it makes me laugh.
It's true. It's true. We have generations of people that, as we alluded to earlier, may not want or feel the need for a second opinion because of the level of stature that a physician has in our communities, which is a good thing. Right. But we haven't schooled the population that there are costs associated with these decisions. Many physicians and physician practices have association with certain labs or certain facilities to get their testing done. And they just send people to their affiliated institutions or facilities. And nobody questions that. No one does what Victoria does and shops around. And I dare say the same few number of people do what now you will be doing, Jamie, and actually auditing yourself and how much you're spending on healthcare. And then by virtue of that, going to look for less expensive alternatives when you really feel the pinch that it's coming out of your pocket. And we know that there is a large segment of our population that doesn't feel that pinch, whether they acknowledge that it's there or not. They don't feel that pinch that it's coming out of their pocket in some such way. So I still think there's a tremendous amount of room for education here, a tremendous amount of room for improvement, but I'm not sure that it's going to happen anytime soon.
Well, I'm surprised, Jamie, actually, that your insurance is already doing that. And, you know, I've just certainly seen some increase, even in my high deductible plan, we've seen a significant increase in cost. But I did not know that those were some of the – I've seen the increase in cost, but I have not necessarily seen the deductible change where you're having to pay the first money out of your pocket for traditional plans. But like Rick said, there's going to have to be some education. I think my case management background, that's what I'm taught to do. I'm taught to negotiate pricing and try to get someone into the least expensive facility and take care, you know, be mindful of those healthcare dollars. So if we are, if we as a nation are going to look at the new healthcare plan, and we are not, you know, who is going to be that person who's educating them? Hopefully, like Jamie's situation, you have those deductibles and you suddenly realize that you're going to have to figure out some way to do it. But, okay, I get the point that I'm going to have to be mindful of my dollars. But if I wasn't a case manager, how would I know to go and negotiate my rate? So whose responsibility is that going to be to educate the new healthcare consumer?
Well, and I think that's going to fall to the policies in certain extents. I know I have to give my wife's insurance company a little bit of credit, because they actually were very proactive in informing people that, hey, you need to really look at the policy this time around. Don't just check it off like you do and send it back to the benefits office. You need to look at this policy. You need to sit down and run your numbers from last year's expenses and see which version of this is going to fit best for your family. And I give them credit for really taking an extra step and explaining how this was going to change and giving some clear examples. That's the beginning of educating this process. And this is a Fortune 500 company, and this change in healthcare benefits is going to affect, my guess is 200 to 300,000 employees across the United States. And if that company's doing it, Victoria, they can't be the only one, because these companies look at trends in benefits and tend to adjust their benefits to be competitive in the marketplace.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear that. And I look forward to seeing some more plans that are doing that kind of thing. I think it's definitely needed.
So coming around, you know, this is a great topic. Real quickly, I want to, before we close out, want to get to this third article here, looking at the flu season's upon us. So we're getting into the flu season, and everybody knows your facilities or your areas have been offering flu vaccines for a little while now. But Rick, you sent an article in that was basically an opinion piece from Medscape, looking at why healthcare employees or healthcare workers should be required to get flu shots. We've talked about this on the show here before, I know, on Insights. But Rick, what are your thoughts since you brought this article to my attention?
My thoughts are, you know, I officially don't know. This is a tough spot to be in. And I started blogging about this back in 2009. I've tried to follow the trends and where this was going since then. But back in 2009, you remember we were dealing with the swine flu showing up here in the United States. And there was here in New York anyways, there was by then Governor Patterson, a mandate that all healthcare workers would be mandated to have the flu vaccine. And the New York State Nurses Association actually came out in opposition to it. And I've kind of proudly sat on the fence and watched both sides and tried to make up a good decision as to whether or not the mandate the shot or not, I guess is what I'm calling it. And this is a tough situation to be in, because it leads us down a road of giving up as individuals your right to decide what type of healthcare you're going to take, or what kind of health preventative measures you're going to take. And, you know, there's a lot of data out there that says sometimes flu, and we're speaking now typically of seasonal flu, type A influenza, seasonal stuff, right? We're not talking about anything exotic or manipulated here. There's some data out there that says that the seasonal flu vaccine may not be 100% effective in all cases. And there's some data out there that suggests that non-pharmacologic measures can be as effective in some cases as the flu vaccine. And nobody's saying don't get the vaccine, but what we're talking about here is being mandated to get the vaccine. The next point is, when does it stop? Now, right now we're talking about flu vaccine, but what's next? Anthrax vaccine, revaccination against smallpox, or as we discussed on Insights a few weeks ago, is it going to be dengue fever, the next vaccine we have to take? Once we start mandating these, when does it stop, and where do we show that people have a choice in healthcare? So that's why I'm sitting right tight on the middle of the fence on this one.
Well, in an attempt to knock you off that fence, Rick, we are already. I mean, this is a public health issue, And we are already in mandating certain vaccines in a public health setting in certain situations. I know when I was in nursing school, I had to prove that I had been vaccinated for the typical childhood illnesses and things as part of my nursing school. And maybe not all schools do that, but it was required basically that I had basic vaccines on board, the basic immunizations set up for highly contagious illnesses. What's the difference between the round of vaccines we all give our kids and requiring something like a flu vaccine for healthcare providers so we don't give pass along the flu to one of our patients?
Yeah, I think the difference there, Jamie, is in one case we're talking about, as you put it, childhood illnesses that most people are vaccinated from or vaccinated against, and we have some level of herd immunity to those things. On the other side, we're talking about seasonal influenza, which changes every year and can arguably cause 35 to 40,000 deaths in the United States. So again, playing both sides of the fence, I advocate everyone being vaccinated who works in healthcare. And I'm not specifically speaking of nurses, but I think everyone from hospital administration right down to those folks that are working hard in environmental services and food services, everybody that walks through the door of that healthcare facility ought to be vaccinated for public health. Especially when we start talking about the potential of having an actual or a threatened public health emergency, they ought to be vaccinated. But as we see a growing trend, I guess maybe it's leveled off a little bit in the last year or so, but a trend in people deciding not to vaccinate their children for whatever reason against some of those childhood illnesses. Will we see an uptick in those illnesses and a decrease in our herd immunity from them? And will we see those diseases come back? And that would lead us then to making sure that everyone is vaccinated against those things who works in healthcare. And again, it removes that personal choice. So, you know, good try for trying to get me out of the middle. But, you know, I'm still stuck right there saying, you know, I can see why we should do this. And I think you have a responsibility to do it. But I also think there's compelling reasons why people could argue against getting vaccinated.
Victoria, are you perched on the fence with Rick?
Well, you know, I do think that there is issues with public health and there is reasons to vaccinate. I personally want to have a personal, my personal freedom would be to let me choose. And to be a devil's advocate here, as someone who works with injured workers, I actually have had a case where a healthcare worker was required, mandated, to take the flu vaccine and got Guillain-Barré and has permanent damage left over from the Guillain-Barré. So, you know, there are risks to the injection. There are also consequences by making that healthcare choice. Just as Rick said, you know, you have to prove these things before you can go to nursing school. And perhaps if you take your choice not to have the injections or the vaccinations, then you have the option not to go to nursing school. And the nursing school absolutely has the ability to require those vaccinations. And if you make the choice not to do so, then you have to abide by those consequences. But I still think, I understand in the interest of public health, we want to highly encourage and educate people. But, and just like we've done with, you know, the smallpox and the chickenpox vaccines and the hepatitis vaccines, was I vaccinated? Yes, I was vaccinated. Now, and I certainly agree with vaccination, but I still want to have my healthcare choice. I don't want anybody to mandate it to me, and certainly not mandate it unless they have fully educated me on the risk of what could happen.
Really, I don't want to be misconstrued as being against seasonal flu vaccine for healthcare workers. I am 100% in favor of everyone being vaccinated for seasonal flu. That's something that is got a low risk, with the exception of course the case that Victoria brings up, and I'm sure there's others. But it's on a larger scale, it's a safe vaccine. We can prevent transmission of seasonal influenza to at-risk populations in a healthcare setting. I think we should do that. I also think you should have some type of choice in the matter as well. I don't want to even open up the box of transferring people to non-clinical situations if they choose not to get vaccinated. Again, my concern is in the absence of a public health emergency, mandating someone to get a vaccine could lead us down a slippery slope of then mandating you to get all kinds of vaccines that may or may not be efficacious in all settings. That's really where my concern lies.
And I'd want to know what is the effect of vaccinating large numbers of the healthcare worker population? I mean, this is another opportunity for some evidence-based practice. What is the relationship between percentage of healthcare workers vaccinated and numbers of people in a facility presenting with a certain illness? That might be something to look into, but I know that there are places that are going about this through a little bit of social engineering methods. And I've got to look up the article, but I remember several articles talking about organizations that were either requiring healthcare workers to get a flu vaccine uh-huh. this year, or they had to wear a mask during all patient contact situations.
I'm okay with that. You know, that's what I was talking about before. As long as you have a choice, and then you have to abide by the consequences of that choice. If that mm-hmm. consequence is that you have to wear gloves and a mask or whatever else to take care of patients, no matter what it is that you're doing, well, that's your prerogative because that's the choice that you made.
Victoria, I agree with that. You know, the non-pharmacologic measures often don't get as much attention as they should. You know, simple hand washing, respiratory etiquette, and appropriate social distancing. You know, stay home. It's not going to be popular with the employers out there. Stay home if you're sick, right? That's a great way not to spread disease, along with the good hygiene practices. But again, then are we going to tell visitors and family members that they have to be vaccinated in order to come into a healthcare facility? Or are we going to request them to wear masks? Well, I think we should.
Well, and we have in the past. I mean, and many facilities still have signs up during flu season. If you are sick, please do not visit your friend and relative.
Right. And who screens that? Who checks that?
Nobody checks it, but at least there's somebody.
Who turns away family member at the door if they have symptoms. Nobody does that. And it's a voluntary thing.
But it's an education. It's an education item. You know, people don't often think about that because their employer requires them to come in, whether they're sick or not, for good or bad. But maybe if you educate them, oh, you know what? I have a sore throat. I've had a sore throat all day. I hadn't even really thought about it when I came to the hospital, but I probably shouldn't go upstairs and visit Aunt Jean right now. And I'm going to go ahead and call up and say, hey, you know what? I'm not feeling well. I don't want to make you sick. I'll come and visit you in a couple of days. I think it comes down to public and patient education. I think that's a good place to wrap it up, Victoria, unless you have any final thoughts.
No, I think we've pretty much agreed on all of that, and we are maybe getting ready to make a list of evidence-based practice projects for nursing educators, maybe.
Yeah, people can contact us here at Insights in Nursing if you're looking for an idea for a research project. Listen to this episode, because I think there's probably 10 or 15
in here. We have a list for you.
Well, great. Hey, Victoria, while I have you here, why don't you go ahead and tell folks where they can find you out there on the web?
Absolutely. VP Medical Consulting is located in Central Arkansas. Our website is vp-medical.com, and we're on Twitter and Facebook as well. And come check it out.
And Victoria, thanks for being on the show today.
Thank you. I enjoyed it as always.
I'm glad we were able to connect. Hey, Rick, where can folks find you?
mitigationjournal.org, and you can email me at mitigationjournal@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from everybody, and this has been a stellar episode of Insights, Jamie. Victoria, it's been great talking with you.
Thank you, I agree.
Well, it's been a lot of fun for me. I love bringing up some good articles and then listening to the discussion as much as I think the listeners do, because I learn so much from doing these things, and so I thank both of you for being on the show today. I would like to remind you, you can find me over at nursingshow.com and, of course, here as the host at Insights in Nursing at insightsinnursing.com. If you want to get back in touch with us, if you have a question, a comment, or a suggestion for a future episode, send those items in to insightsinnursing@gmail.com. And please keep in touch with us and check back here soon for another episode here of Insights in Nursing.